Welcome to Navigating Life with Neurodiversity, a podcast about identity, healing, and honest conversations for those who feel deeply, think differently, and live uniquely. My name is Matt, and I'm glad you're here. This week, I took a break from planning and recording content and explanations of the neurodiverse world that I navigate. Instead, I took a few days to reflect on how I got here. I left the prison service 8 years ago and initially applied for a role with a private ambulance service for a patient transport services role. And instead, they offered me an opportunity to train as an emergency care assistant. To be honest, I just bit their hand off. The bottom rung of the clinical ladder as an ECA is no less vital in the chain of survival. I still remember the first job I ever attended. It was a PR bleed, and the technician that I worked with had asked me to attend, essentially throwing me in at the deep end. Upon entering the property, I looked around at what could easily have been the set from a gory horror film, and I just froze. I remember thinking, how the fuck am I here? I am way out of my depth, and I should just go back to getting assaulted every day. The senior clinician I was with recognised it immediately and took over. But that's how the journey started. One shift at a time, one patient at a time. Then I was wide-eyed, absorbing everything around me. The paramedics or the techs that I crewed with were so impressive. Not just in their skill, but in their presence. They were calm in a storm. Watched the way that they spoke, how they held themselves. How they found the words when none seemed enough. Some of them were gruff, others were nurturing, but each has left a mark. I learned to listen more than I speak and to ask the right questions. I also learned how to find my role in the team without needing to shout for it. After 18 months as an ECA, I felt ready to make that step up to a technician, confident in my ability to transition without grasping just how large that step is. On reflection, I still maintain that the jump from ECA to technician is so much larger than the gap from technician to paramedic. It's funny though, because I thought the nerves would settle, but they didn't. If anything, the pressure grew. I was expected to know more, act quicker, and bridge the invisible gap between being part of a crew and being part of or leading the clinical decisions. I saw more of the messiness, not just the physical kind, but the emotional, the grief, the fear, anger and loneliness. And I started to carry some of it with me, like quiet passengers that linger after a long day. But obviously, I've had challenges along the way. And let's face it, I never do things the easy way. But I operated at this level for 4 years before deciding again that I wanted to do more. Again, feeling confident that my knowledge outweighed my scope of practice. I was becoming frustrated with working within the constraints of my role. So I found myself enrolling in university. Again, my confidence outweighed the reality. My mind was, I'm basically already a paramedic. I'm just not allowed to do a few things. That was how I thought of myself. Yet again, I was humbled. I think the best explanation of this step in clinical skill is understanding the why. Before, I could sit down in front of a patient and I could tell you what we needed to do according to policy and procedure. But becoming a paramedic was learning about why we do things the way we do, learning to take everything I already knew and come up with things on the fly. Not just to blindly follow a textbook, but to take a toolkit and fix any problem. A deeper understanding then revealed a greater depth of the unknown unknowns, or the things that I didn't know. But I kept going, because somewhere underneath the doubt, there's a quiet determination to earn it. To prove, more to myself than to anyone else, that I am as good as I say I am, and justify the ego. And now I'm here, almost on the other side of that bridge, staring down a path to independent practice. I should be excited. I am kind of excited, but if honest, I'm also scared and nervous. There's a particular kind of anxiety that comes with being almost ready. Like standing on the edge of a cliff after years of climbing. You know the view's going to be incredible, but you also know that the next steps mean that you're the one responsible for the rope. I think back to the mentors who helped me get here. Some were formal teachers, others were those I crewed with who shared quiet wisdom in between calls, or believed in me when I didn't believe in myself. And I've been incredibly fortunate over the years. Whilst I've had the occasional bad shift or experience, I have always had great mentors to learn from. Each of them have got different styles of teaching, different styles of leading, different styles of working, all of which have contributed massively to how I've developed my own style of work. And I would be remiss if I didn't take a quick moment to say thank you to everyone that helped me along this way, to everybody that climbed the ladder ahead of me and then offered a helping hand. I've worked with some really good people. Also recently learned how to separate the paramedic from the person. I can be grateful for the mentorship and education given to me by a truly wonderful paramedic, even if that person is someone that I can no longer tolerate as part of my life. And still, even after all of these years, the progress, the patience, there is still the jobs that make me crack. And there was one quite recently. As I've said, I've been in the ambulance service for nearly 8 years now. And that's 8 years of brutality and beauty, sometimes in the same breath. I've seen things that most people couldn't imagine. I've seen fatal road traffic collisions, pediatric deaths, suicides that often leave more questions than answers. Scenes where the blood doesn't stop running and hope runs out faster than the adrenaline. But somehow through it all, I've always kept going, call after call, shift after shift. No work-related breakdowns, no lingering nightmares. I'd always assumed that this meant I was resilient, built differently. Maybe my neurodivergence helped with it. It helps me switch off. It put my feelings into little mental boxes and stack them in the corner out the way. People have said that I can be composed, but I say that I'm just great at switching it off. Until one job, just before Christmas last year, visited a 100-year-old man on his deathbed with norovirus. Severely dehydrated, fragile, fading. He wasn't fighting anymore, wasn't panicked. He was just kind of waiting, like quiet, tired, not in pain, just ready. But what got to me wasn't his condition. It was what he chose to talk about in his last moments. His ex-wife came home from work one day when he was 40, and she told him that she regretted marrying him, she didn't love him and couldn't be with him anymore, and left. And he revealed to us that he never dated again, not because he didn't want to, but to use his words, what would be the point? None of them are her. And he'd carried that heartbreak with him for 60 years, longer than the relationship lasted, and he was still speaking of her like he lost her yesterday. And it hit a nerve. I cracked. Not dramatically, not in front of him. I stayed professional, steady, supportive in a way. I sat in the corner, quietly completing the paperwork as silent tears streamed down my face. Now, if he's listening, my crewmate will know the job. And to his credit, he continued with the assessment and didn't acknowledge my crying moment. Something that I greatly appreciated. This time it wasn't the death that hurt, it was the love, or more accurately in his case, the absence of it. What he said didn't land as a story from someone else's life, but it hit a nerve within my own. At the time, I was still processing my own kind of loss. I had been suddenly and ruthlessly discarded by someone I adored. No closure, no explanation that just made sense. Just gone. And despite everything that I've seen and survived in my job, that's what left me gasping for air. His heartbreak reflected my fear that I will never be enough for someone. I will never be the one that someone chooses to stay with, that no matter how deeply I love or how hard I try or how much of myself I give, it isn't enough, just like it wasn't for her. And in him, I saw myself alone, 100, missing someone who moved on decades before. The call didn't traumatize me in a clinical sense, but it exposed a wound that was already there. A quiet aching beneath the surface, masked by uniform, masked by protocol, and a perfectly timed sense of detachment. For the first time, I didn't feel like a clinician who had seen it all. I felt like a human who couldn't outrun his own fear of being forgotten or left behind or never loved enough. Which is kind of funny in a weird way. After all of the horrific things I've witnessed, all of the lives ending in chaos and tragedy, It was actually one man's quiet, lifelong pining that undid me. Not because of what had happened to him, but because I saw myself in his story. And I realized maybe for the first time, that the pain we don't treat, the emotional weight we ignore, is the kind that festers the longest. That job reminded me that what breaks us isn't always the loudest moment. Sometimes it's the whisper of someone else's grief that resonates too closely to our own. Sometimes the worst trauma isn't the scene itself, it's when the story overlaps with our deepest or most personal aches. And maybe that's the real price of this job, not the trauma we see, but the mirrors that we occasionally can't look away from. People often assume that if something doesn't make me cry on the spot, or if I can still make a joke after a brutal job, then it hasn't affected me, that this is just another day and I'm fine. But the truth is, I just process it differently, as I've mentioned before. I often process it late, not because I don't feel it, but because I feel it too much, but just not all at once. It's like grief or sadness or heartbreak comes to me on a delay. Obviously, neurodivergence plays a part in that, but it gives me the ability to emotionally compartmentalize with surgical precision. I've always been able to walk away from devastating scenes without a scratch on the surface. But it doesn't mean that nothing gets in. It just means I don't notice the cracks until later, when I'm driving home, lying awake in bed, or fully dressed, laid on the floor of my shower. Sometimes it's hearing a stranger say something that echoes a buried memory that I'm just not ready to revisit. Sometimes I don't even register that a call has hit me until days later, and even then, the emotional response feels disjointed, unpredictable. I won't cry for a child who didn't survive, but I'll dissolve over a man who lived to 100 and died of dehydration, grieving a woman he lost 60 years ago. Doesn't mean I'm broken, it just means that I process things in layers, in echoes, in shadows. And this latest one, this man's grief, it didn't just bring sadness, it opened up fear. A fear that's been sitting in me unspoken for quite a while, and the fear that I will never just be enough for someone. That I'll be remembered, but maybe not chosen, not loved the way I want to be, not kept. When you live with neurodivergence, especially as someone wired for deep, hyper intense connections, the losses don't always land cleanly. They rattle. If you're anything like me, you find ways to keep moving, you throw yourself into your work, you get really good at appearing unaffected, and you tell yourself it's just all noise until something cuts through, and then suddenly you're not okay. You don't know how to explain why this one thing, this one story, was the thing that made you fall apart. And I think that's why I often process later, in private or in pieces, because I've built my emotional survival around control and grief, and when it finally gets through, it just doesn't ask for permission. But here's the part that I'm still learning. Feeling doesn't mean I've failed. Breaking down after a call doesn't make me weak. It makes me real. It means that I do still care. It means that I haven't lost the part of me that connects, that wants to be seen, loved, or chosen. And maybe that's the hardest part of my job, not the trauma itself, but carrying your own invisible wounds with you to every call. Doing your best to still hold space for others when there are days where you don't know how to hold space for yourself. But I'm still here. I'm still standing. I'm still almost human. And maybe that's enough. I don't have all the answers, despite seeming to have an answer for everything. But I do know that I'm grateful for my career, from being green to wearing green, for the hands that lifted me up when I've stumbled, for the patients who shared their most vulnerable moments with me, even for my occasional cracks. And if I'm scared now, it's only because I do care deeply, because I want to do this job well, I want to do it right, because I know what it means to be someone's lifeline, even if it's just for 10 minutes. So I keep going, I keep improving, with gratitude, with fear, with hope. Maybe in time the fear fades, but the compassion is something I hope stays. Thanks for listening to Navigating Life with Neurodiversity. If this episode resonated, follow on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from, share it with someone you care about, or leave a review. It all helps more than you know. Until next time, be kind to yourselves.